All right, so maybe the conclusion of Hebrews chapter 11. The problem is I don't remember where we stopped last week, but last week I didn't remember where we stopped the week before. So we're going to start wherever you guys want. I think we talked about Joseph and Moses' parents and Moses.
I thought we were doing something like Gideon, Barak, and Samson.
Did we make it all the way down there?
In that area.
We pretty much got through all the majors.
Yeah.
Okay.
Isaac and Jacob.
Let's start with number 11 then, where it says the Israelites. Like, they were commended. Let me open. I actually don't have my scripture open. They were commended for their faith, like, as a nation. I just thought that was hilarious because they seemed like one of the most faithless bunches out there. But then again, oh yeah, we did talk about this because I said it definitely took some faith to step into that parted sea. You know, the waters that were parted definitely took a lot of faith just to do that. So I'll give them that, and I'll give them faith. You know, even though they complained a lot and could have turned around, they didn't. You know, they didn't turn back to Egypt. They talked about it. They threatened to do it. But in the long run, they stayed the course. So even despite their moments of unfaith, like they didn't have faith to walk into the promised land like God had originally called them to do, and it took them 40 years in the wilderness, despite that, they still had faith to stay that course, even when it took a generation longer than it was supposed to take. And also, the Israelites walked through the dry ground. I wrote in the notes, they walked through the dry ground by faith. The Egyptians walked through it by kind of like, well, I guess we'll be fine too, but they didn't have faith in the God that parted those waters. And so when they stepped into to that parted sea, but not with faith in God, right, God drowned them.
Just followed Moses.
They just followed Moses and the people, but they didn't have any faith themselves. And so they drowned. And I think we find ourselves, you know, in a situation in life where it's like we could, you know, we could be saying, well, this looks like good, like a good thing, and we embark on it, and I'm not saying God's going to drown us, I'm just saying it's like, wait a minute, we weren't going with faith in God on this. We were walking on our own might, and we saw a road paved out before, so we just started down it, but God's saying, wait a minute, I didn't lead you through that, I didn't lead you down that. And so, just because a way appears open in front of us doesn't mean that God is open that way up, if that makes sense. Thoughts or comments?
Well, I always thought that if you started down the wrong way, figuring it was the plan, that if it wasn't, God shut the doors on you, so whatever you were thinking was going to go, you know, he put obstacles in front of you, and then you finally, if you were wise enough, would decide, well, I guess this is not where I'm supposed to go.
Yeah.
And stop and listen.
Yeah.
Oh boy, that little one.
Yeah, poor baby.
He just have the mom, you know.
Yeah, I get it.
Clingy.
I understand that.
There's two of them. One wants to be clingy more than the other one already, whether they know it or not. Right? He's got mom. I got mom.
Well, with the Israelites a few decades later, you know, despite what we think, they didn't have faith, they did, and it's, I think, important to highlight not just their faith failures, but their faith, you know, victories that they had. And one of those was marching into the promised land and camping around Jericho and looking at these walls that were 15 or more feet thick. There's no way a simple group of wilderness dwellers and, you know, herdsmen, basically, there's no way that they have the ability to take that city on their own faith or their own strength, I mean, not their own faith.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Okay. The Israelites that went into Canaan.
Yes.
How many of the miracles did they actually see that God did?
Oh, chances are the ones that actually entered the promised land, probably a very low percentage had actually witnessed anything that occurred in Egypt, those miracles, those.
Well, no, the ones that, you know, of going across on dry ground and water from the rock, and, you know, God at his holy mountain.
I'm sure there were some that had been, you know, children or babies during that. and probably some of those remember it with their own eyes. But I would say a lot of those kids were born in the wilderness. First of all, how do I put it? They're camping for 40 years. Yeah. Nobody really got a job. There's going to be a lot of babies born.
So
some of those, the Promised Land generation, all they knew was the wilderness, but they knew the stories. I mean, the other part, you know, what do you do around a campfire? You tell stories.
Okay.
So they story told a lot.
So their faith probably was greater than their parents' faith because they were going in because of what their parents had told them.
Yeah.
That was true. But, you know.
Well, like Jesus said to Thomas, you believe now that you've seen? Blessed are the ones who believe having not seen. You know, that generation hadn't seen those miracles of God. But they also didn't know the powerful hand of the slave owners in Egypt. They didn't know slavery in Egypt. So I think that was part of what maybe poisoned the minds of the generation that left, the Red Sea generation. They knew that slavery that they had been part of, and so it was hard for them to see beyond that. But the kids that were born in the wilderness or that entered it as young children, it was easy enough for them to say, all I've ever heard is that God is going to do something great, you know? And so I think that plays into it. I think, yes, they were so young or even born in the wilderness. I mean, for sure, there was a bunch of them born in the wilderness that were the guys that were marching around Jericho. So they're working on faith just on the heritage of the stories. And also think, they've eaten food every day that
yes.
came from the heavens. And so God has, not only that, but no armies have come to invade them and plunder them. You know, even though they were camped around other nations and other nations were traveling around them, maybe nobody hurt them. God protected them for 40 years. So they have a lot of reasons for faith, for sure. And when they go to march around Jericho, it would be really easy for people to say, well, we're nomads. We live in the wilderness. We're just going to stay in the wilderness. But instead, they march in a formation around a city that they, in all reality, cannot conquer. There's just no way they're going to conquer that city. And that city knew it. They weren't locked down. I mean, they were to a degree, but they didn't keep the gates closed like you do if there's an invading army there. They had the gates open because the spies went in there. Remember, there's two spies that go in, and Rahab, who shows up next in the list in Hebrews 11, they go in there, and of course Rahab, we'll bleed into that for a second here. She gets the reputation of being a prostitute because that's what she's called. But she was also called, her job wouldn't have just been like a sexual one like we think of as prostitutes. It would have really been a type of hostel or H-O-S-T-E-L, like a type of lodging place where hospitality was shown. And yeah, that probably did involve female companionship. Who knows? Maybe, maybe not. Don't really know that for sure. It's actually hard to say whether that's, but like, don't think of her as like, what's her name? Pretty Woman, you know, the old movie, Julia Roberts, Pretty Woman, like with the tall boots and the short skirt. Like, don't think Rahab was walking around like that, you know? I mean, maybe, but I doubt it. It was more to do with her place was the natural place that travelers might show up for a meal and a bed. And so, in fact, the spies do go there because that's a natural place for them to show up. And the people looking for the spies show up looking for them at her door. Now, maybe it's because somebody said, yeah, I saw a couple strange guys walking that way. I think they're those Israelites. I don't know. But, you know, she hides them. Why? Because of faith. And if you go back and read her words, she says there's a fear that's over this whole, not just our city, but this whole region on account of you guys, because we know that your God is with you. So they understood that God was with them, that they understood that God was with those peoples. And so she recognized we're on the losing side of things. That God is justified in it. Somehow she knew enough, and it makes me believe that there was Israelites who would go into that city from time to time, you know, they live nearby in the wilderness, but they're coming into the city for trading, for supplies, for whatever. And so there's probably been enough chatter about who are these people? Why are they here? What are they going to do next? That she had heard these things and somehow she listened to it and said, okay, God's doing something here. And I want to be on the side of that God and not these false gods that my people seem to worship that I don't think they can save us. Their faith is in these walls, but these people seem to have a bigger faith than what my people have. Their walls and their gods are made out of stone. These people's God, they don't even carry an idol with them. There's something about that. And so she sees the faith of the people of Israel, and it brings faith in her so much so that she does two things. She hides the spies, and she also stays in the city waiting for the deliverance because the spies promised her, which is interesting to me that they had the ability to do that. They spoke on behalf of God and of Joshua, their leader, and said, if you hang this cord that they lowered down out of, if you hang the cord out your window on the day of the invasion, it's going to be fine. And so her whole family was saved. They said, anybody that's in your house will be saved.
You can bring well, the
so,
back to
so,
Rahab.
Yeah, back to Rahab.
Her holding that cord down there, that's like a precursor to Christ.
Right.
If we hold on to him,
yeah,
we are saved, just like
yeah.
anybody who was in that.
Well, I don't think that it's anything to skip over, to gloss over the fact that that cord was scarlet red, the color of blood, the blood of Christ that saves us. Yeah. You know, that there has to be some foreshadowing there.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. All right.
We'll just bring it
here over. Look at this. We're heavily weighted on the right side of the table today because last week I said we're going to only have people on the right side talking. Man, they were terrible about following that. Rahab, the Israelites, and not to, just one more thing, not to belabor, but one more thing about Jericho. When they walked around that, they walked around it for 6 days with nothing happening. Like, that's another moment of faith that the Israelites have. 6 days, one time a day? Can you imagine showing up to work for like an hour a day and saying, I did my day's work? No, you didn't. Nobody works an hour a day. Except pastors, we only work an hour a week, apparently.
How big is that city, though? How long would it take?
I don't know, actually. I've never found info on that.
It may have been really sprawling.
It could have been.
It'll take a long time to get around.
My guess is it didn't take that long, yeah. Especially since they did seven times in a day on the last day of it and then went in and, well, burned and slaughtered the city.
And how many people, too?
Yeah,
were doing this. I mean, it might have taken a full day for everybody to get around.
Sure. Now, and also here's the other thing, like, archaeologists are, they're some of the dumbest, most aggravating people at times, because just like any other field of discipline, whether that's, some type of science or medical discipline or whatever it might be, these people get a preconceived idea of what they believe the truth is, and then they dig to prove it right. Rather than dig and find where the facts lead them, they say, well, this is what we already know, and so this is going to be, you know, the solution. Well, the thing is, archaeologists believe that they do. There are a lot of them that believe there was an Israelite people that did a conquest of this land of Canaan. They don't argue that because they see enough evidence of such a conquest and a shift of people groups. You know, there was one group that had a very, you know, their worship system and their system of life matches the description of the Canaanite people that were there. You know, they can find evidence of shrines, altars, idols, all those things from that era. And so they say, oh, well, these people lived here. And then there seems to be a dramatic shift, some type of conquest, lots of overtaken villages and cities where they dug them up. But we haven't even dug up 10% of biblical historical sites in Israel, and probably never will get them all. But the point is, there's a lot of unexplored history in the ground. So the sites that they have found, they have to match them up with what they already believe exists. So archaeologists will go to a site where ancient Jericho was, and they'll say, well, this can't be the right place, because the evidence of when this destruction happened is 150 years earlier than what we know happened of the story of Moses and all that. There's a guy, what's his name? I can see his face. He has a Mahoney. Gail, you know this guy because he borrowed my videos for 2 years on. Anyway, I got DVDs.
Evidence and Demand.
Not that. That's Josh McDowell's old book. This is something evidence. Anyway, it's all about a timeline shift that he believes is accurate on when the Exodus happened and all that. And it matches a lot more. It matches a lot more archaeological evidence, but the existing knowledge, air quotes, says, well, no, that can't be right, because we know the Egyptian, you know, Exodus happened at this time in the Bronze Age, Middle Bronze Age, or whatever it is. Well, he says if you shift the timeline and you slide the timeline back, now all of a sudden these events start lining up with what we're finding in the ground. So they found evidence of a city of, like, Jericho that had 15-foot thick walls, and that the walls, every bit of the archaeological evidence matches the story in the book of Joshua. The walls of this city that were very wide collapsed inward. They didn't just shatter and crumble out a section with lodging an attack against it. The walls of the city fell inward. And this, it says that the people, the soldiers, the troops of Israel were able to go up into the city, every man straight up into the city. That can only happen if the walls fall in. Then they were able to put the city to the sword and to burn it. Now, what you will find of a city that's had a long attack against it, you know, is the gates are shut, nobody gets in or out, and you have to survive off of what is in the city. Your food, your materials, your supplies. So what you'll find in a city that's been under siege for, it used to take a year or more sometimes to overthrow a city like that. They would build earthen ramps up to them and all this stuff to get into the wall. Of course, you got guys shooting arrows at you and stuff like that the whole time. And so it's like, you know, kind of like when you think of when the Allied invasion to Normandy, you know, like you've got machine guns and grenades and all this stuff being thrown at you, and you're trying to land people on the beach, go up a hill, like, the scale of that kind of invasion is insane. There's going to be a large loss of life.
Yeah.
There's no evidence of that. Not only that, but they found pots that are charred from smoke that are full of grain still today in this Jericho city that they've unearthed. It matches a city that fell quickly without depleting its food supplies and resources.
Wow.
Just like the biblical story.
Wow.
So now we've got, you know, evidence in the ground that they've unearthed that says the Bible story matches it perfectly, exactly what we see here. But of course, these archaeologists, who are most of them atheists, you know, a big chunk of them are, they're funded by university most of the time. And they say, well, that doesn't match what we know to be true timeline. Well, guess what? Shift your timeline and it matches. And so we see that, but the faith that the people of Israel had to walk around that city for 6 days and do nothing, and then on the seventh day to march around it seven times and then just shout and have victory over it. Amazing. That is amazing. That's a faith that I don't know if I have. Yes.
Did you say, is this unearthed Jericho and the location where?
Yeah, it matches other location and everything.
Okay.
But, you know, for some reason, some of these archaeologists don't buy into it. And they can have their own dumb opinions. They're just wrong. I haven't been there, so I can't tell you, but I've seen video of it and I've seen testimony about it. And I'm good enough with that. Like, just like the Israelite children that went into there, having faith from the testimony they've heard. I've heard the testimony makes sense. I believe that God did it anyway, and so that's enough evidence for me. I'm good with it. And I'll teach it just like I did and say, God did this and this is what happened. So Rahab had faith to trust in God despite what all of her fellow countrymen believed. And not only did she have faith to trust in God, but she saved her life and her family's life, whoever was in that room with her. And this is another time where I see something in scriptures when one person leads them, they're walking to Christ, they can lead their entire family to Christ. We just need one.
Like the jailer.
Like the jailer that responded to Paul and Silas after they'd been beaten and jailed, and then all of a sudden they, the gates are blown open and the shackles are flung off. The jailer was about to do himself in, and Paul said, wait, we're all still here. And that's when he trembled. He said, why are you guys still here? You're free, is what he's thinking. And so then the jailer says, he falls down on his knees before Paul and Silas. This never happens in jail. The warden bowing to the inmates. And he says, what is it that I need to do to be saved? What do I need to do to be saved? So that very night, he bathed Paul and Silas' wounds, and then he and his whole family were baptized. His faith led his whole family to Christ. Don't give up yet. Don't give up on your family. Right? Yeah.
Never give up.
The author of Hebrews goes in what we put as number 13 on our list. He says, I don't have time to talk about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets. Well, I mean, we don't either, but I'll talk about them anyway, real briefly, which is a laugh if you know me that well, but I'll try to be brief. Gideon, he's simply the guy that says, who, me? Just like Moses had. He's hiding out from, I think it was the Midianites that he was hiding from.
Yes.
But he's hiding out threshing grain in a wine press. So in other words, he's down below. It's hard to thresh grain where the wind doesn't hit because you got to fling it into the air and let the wind carry the chaff away. But instead of being up on level ground, he's down below because, and I think he might have even been doing it at night, right? Because, the Midianites were basically stealing all their food too. Talk about a way to enrich yourself and also weaken your enemy is take their food away. Great, you win automatically. And so Gideon's trying to at least keep some of their own food supply. And so he's threshing grain in a wine press. And this guy shows up. Now, he doesn't immediately know it's an angel of the Lord. Looks like a man. But this guy shows up and he's like, hey, mighty warrior. And he just kind of looks around like, who are you talking to, my man? And he's like, no, you, son. And I'm talking to you. He's like, no, it's not me. And this is kind of like Moses at the burning bush, Like, all right, you're going to do this. And he says, nah, you got the wrong guy, God. Somebody else is going to do that. And he argues with God, and finally he just says, seriously, pick someone else. And he's like, no, I picked you. Gideon ends up leading a big thing, where he, much like Jericho, he has this victory with few weapons. Their weapons were a torch under a clay pot and a trumpet. Now, what's interesting is he leads a revolt against 100 and some thousand people with only 300 troops. He starts out by gathering an army of 30-something thousand. God says it's too many. He whittles it down by to 10% of that at 3,000 and some. And then God's like, nah, it's still too many. I can't win with that many people. Like, you might be able to win, but I can't win is what God says. And Gideon's like, I told you this was dumb when you met me at the wine press. Why are you doing this to me, God? And yet Gideon goes through with it. He doesn't run away like most of us want to. He's like, no, you're going to conquer an army of 100-some-odd thousand people with 300 men.
Did he not test God before he did?
He did.
Before he
sure did.
Really,
yeah,
decided that God was speaking.
Yeah, two tests, right?
Yep.
Like, here, I got this sheep wool. Make it dry and the ground wet. Okay, well, make the ground dry and it wet. It doesn't matter. God's like, fine, I'll play your games. How long are you going to wait until deliverance, until victory?
Well, I think he was not really sure.
He wasn't sure.
And I guess testing God, like sometimes we do, then we know for sure, and okay, I'm not going to say no anymore. I'm going to do whatever you tell me to do.
And that's why I look at it like, it's not that it was so much like him testing God. It's just God saying, okay, you want to play these games? I'll play along with you for a while, but eventually I'm going to still call you back to do the job I gave you to do. Like, once you're sure of it, that, you know, that it's really me telling you, fine. If you need these games, you can play these games. But God doesn't play games for long. We're thankful that he plays our games sometimes, because otherwise we might still be sitting on the couch never doing anything for the kingdom. But he'll play along for a while. So that's Gideon. They lead this big battle where, and I love the part where he's still not quite sure. And so they go down to the camp of the Midianites, and somehow they were able to understand their language. I still don't get that part. But he just, the first 10, he goes up to think there's 100,000 men encamped there. But he goes up and he sneaks up. I picture there's like firelight so you can see them, but they can't see you sneaking up in the dark. And you sneak up to this camp, and the first thing he overhears is a guy saying, man, I had a dream, and there was a rock. This big rock rolls down the hill and takes out our whole camp. And the other guy goes, this can be nothing other than Gideon, son of whatever, you know, the hand of Gideon. And he's like, holy cow, that's me, you know, like, how did he know? And he's like, okay, God, we're ready, let's roll. And so they surround the camp. They just have torches, but the torches are hidden. And so then all they got to do, I don't know why they had to break all the clay pots over the torches instead of just this. Maybe it's because they're hot. But they break the pots somehow or another. But they're scattered around, so they think that every torch is a leader of a group of soldiers, you know, a few thousand soldiers, and they blow a trumpet. Well, 300 trumpets, 300 torches, you know, those are their weapons, and the Midianites are in panic now because they think they're surrounded and they're surely going to die. And Gideon's like, oh, that worked. Like, did everybody else, let's go lay them on the road, you know? And so they're just, I mean, the Midianites are just leaving riches. I don't know why they brought all their riches with them, but they did. Maybe because they've been invading other places, and so they brought all that stuff with them. You know, they just keep amassing more and more, and they're like, they just leave it as they go. And Gideon's like, wow, God did it. And the people were like, wow, Gideon wasn't a lunatic, you know? Like, and so then you've got Barak. He's got like two verses, you know, but he leads the people. Samson, I actually talked about him a little bit Sunday briefly. My goodness, Samson's favorite things were, I'll try to be clean here, women of the night and killing people. Like, those were his favorite things, man. Like, that's all he did. Oh, and drinking. He liked to party and drink a lot, too. These were the things he was not supposed to do. Specifically him, with the Nazarite vow since he was born, he's supposed to avoid dead bodies, women, booze, all this stuff. And instead, he's just got stacks of them around him all the time. He's just piling up bodies, burning entire farm fields with, like, catching foxes, tying their tails together, putting a torch in them. I used to think that meant actually using their tails for the knots. I don't think that's possible, but somehow he put a rope on them or something. Anyway, and he would tie torches to them, light the torches, and send them through the standing grain of the Philistines to get his quote-unquote revenge. Wow, what a dude. He's the guy that leads Israel. We've had some presidents before with some questionable things. Some people would argue we have an incoming one with some questionable things, and some would argue we have an outgoing one with some questionable things. They're probably all correct about that, too. Somehow God can still use some of these guys. Someday a gal, probably. So far, no luck on that. Sorry, ladies. But, you know, someday God will, some of these people, God will use them despite their weird inadequacies and sinful pasts or presents or all that stuff. And God can still do some great things in a nation through those people.
Yeah.
God did that in the time of the exile, where it says he actually used different foreign kings. Like, he says, you know, Darius or Cyrus, you know, these guys are my chosen instrument, you know, to rebuild the temple. After he had chosen a guy to destroy it, you know, with, what's his name? The Babylonian guy.
Nebuchadnezzar.
Thank you. I couldn't think of his name. You know, he's like, I've chosen him, but he will be punished for what he does. You know, then he chooses someone else to restore it. It's like, amazing. Jephthah, I can't even remember his stuff right now. I'm drawing a blank. Who knows about Jephthah?
The one with the daughter.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that's the one that said that awful.
We're just gonna skip that one for right now, considering cute young minds that don't need to be worried. Look up Jephthah on your own time. It's in the scriptures. It's one of those things that if I told you all the details about every one of these people in the Bible, you'd be like, what? David, though, you know, again, I think, well, we don't have any examples aside from Christ who, and maybe Job, you could argue, that are like an Enoch, that their character is so perfect that we can look up to it. But yet at the same time, you've got David who had, it seems like, more moral failures than holy attributes. But he's commended for his faith, and he leads faithfully from his youth all the way up through. Sorry, he leads with faith during all that. He doesn't always faithfully lead. Like, sometimes he falls short quite a bit or is in direct sin, which results in thousands of his people dying because of his punishment. Finally, he says, God, I'm the one that sinned, not these people. Yes, but when the leader sins, it affects the nation. But yet David's included as having a strong faith. Samuel has a strong faith, for sure some of the best. And Samuel, you know, we don't really find too much that he ever did wrong. I'm sure there's something there, but I think in his older age, didn't he, his sons were leading astray a little bit, like Eli's sons had. So, I mean, clearly Samuel messed up some stuff. But, you know, kind of by throwing those names in, the writer of Hebrews is saying, I think I made my point. Like, you get it? We come from a long line of people with a solid and strong faith. And then he talks about the judges just in general in verse 32, I believe it says.
You've got that.
He talked about all them. Oh, he just says Samuel and the prophets. Okay, so I just wrote that the judges that he had mentioned, they were both revivalists, except for maybe Samson. Most of them, they led a spiritual revival, and, you know, a worship revival where they returned to God, but they also were warriors or fighters in some way or another. So that's what the judges did. They fought against the oppressors of the day, but they also brought the religious culture back to focus on God. So it definitely takes faith to look at the way the people are living and say, this is not righteousness. You know, true righteousness is, you know, and to paint the picture what that would look like and to call the people to return to that. That takes a lot of faith to do that. Now, verse 38, at the beginning of it, it says, it talks about some other stuff. If we skip down a little bit, it says, you know, it had talked about people just before that who faced jeers and flogging. They were chained, put in prison, stones, some other nasty stuff. And it said they went about in sheepskins, goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. Have you ever felt, not in a proud or haughty way, but have you ever felt sometimes, at least when the church has been at its best, that the world isn't worthy, not of you as a person, but just in general, like when you see the way the world's living, say, man, like this world, it's just not worthy of us, and yet God's called us to the world.
What do you mean by not worthy of us?
Ah, I'm glad you asked. So I went on a reading thing. I've got a Bible, not here, but it's got the apocryphal scriptures. And if you're not familiar with those, it would be, for instance, like the Roman Catholic Bible has several books and a few additions to some existing books that we don't have in, say, the Protestant canon of scripture. The notable ones are the story of the book of Tobit, which is a story mainly of the old man named Tobit, his son Tobias, and his journey of meeting with an angel that he doesn't know is an angel, which also pops up in here that it says, or maybe that's in chapter 12. I can't remember since I've done three chapters at once here. It says some people, without knowing, they entertained angels. I think that's in chapter 12. And so, or 13, I don't know. Anyway, he entertains an angel that goes with him on a journey, and his journey is basically to find a noble wife, and Tobias ends up finding her, and God's just at work through all of this. And also, really, Tobias is going to find some money that his father left with another guy in another city. It's a weird story, and it doesn't read like anything else you're used to in the scriptures. And maybe that's why it's not included in the Protestant canon of scriptures. I'm not sure. But you read that one. You read, there's Baruch, which I think is a book of kind of wisdom sayings. There's the Wisdom of Solomon is the name of a book. There's... there's a few others. There's some additions to Esther, to Daniel, and to something else, I think. Oh, Psalm 151, which is in the Israelite canon of scripture. You know, Psalm stops at 150, but they have a 151st Psalm in this, you know, apocryphal edition. But then, by the way, Daniel kills a dragon in the apocryphal additions to Daniel, not with a sword, but with something that he feeds it. So that's pretty cool. Anyway, then you've got this book, four, you know, first, second, third, and fourth Maccabees. And that goes, tells the story of Israelite faithful ones through the Maccabean period, which was, I think, around 200 BC. And so it's in the time between our testaments that that takes place. And some of the things that happen in second Maccabees is what is being referenced here in Hebrews. So even though that wasn't in the Jewish canon of scripture, what we call the Old Testament, it was a writing that they treasured and that they had. So in Maccabees, you've got this invading army that's trying to oppress the Israelites yet again. Remember, the exiles happened, they returned from exile, and yet now they're still being oppressed by other nations. And in the Maccabean period, named after a guy named Judas Maccabee. Anybody heard of him?
Yes, and he's the one that had a revolution.
Yes, you remember his nickname? I love his nickname.
No, not really.
The Hammer. He was so feared. He's so cool. Here's what he did. He left. Like, everything's getting bad around the city, so they get out of there. They go hide in caves in the ground, in the countryside. So that's what it's saying, when they hid in hills and caves, or caves and hills, I mean. Hiding in sheepskins and goatskins, like they don't even have regular clothes, so they're having to slaughter animals and wear that. They're out there, but not just to hide. They're out there to regroup. He gathers an army of 6,000 men from all the. He goes to villages like at night, like come fight with me, you know, like be my soldiers. So he gathers an army together, and they get prepared, and they start attacking these outposts or these like encampments of enemies that are all around them. And they start taking cities, but they go at night. They sneak in, they lay waste to them. And they get to be feared. Like all these Romans that are taking over the world start fearing the Hammer and his army. It's so cool. I mean, this guy is awesome. So it's worth reading some of that. But also in the Maccabees, it talks about the tortures that are inflicted leading up to that time, the tortures that are inflicted on faithful servants of God. See, we've been told that the time between the Testaments, between the Old and New Testament, is 400 years long, and that God was silent during that time. And to a large part, he was, in the sense of there weren't any recorded prophets that were speaking in the voice of God during that time. So when the angel shows up to speak with Zechariah and say that John the Baptist is going to be born to them, this is God breaking his silence in that moment. That's what's so beautiful about it. That's not to say that the people of God were without faith during that time. They were actually very faithful. This is when Judaism is beginning to flourish as a religion, where they're saying, we've got to make sure that we observe God's Torah and God's laws, and we observe his festivals and his Sabbaths. That was one of the biggest things that the Romans and the occupying forces tried to change about the Israelites, was they tried to force them to eat pork, and they tried to force them to work on the Sabbath, to not observe the Sabbaths. And so if you find somebody observing the Sabbath, you know that they're your enemy, if you're the Roman forces, and so they would persecute them. So that's why the Judas Maccabee and his people went and hid, was because they wanted a place where they could observe the Sabbath. And I think that's instructive to me and to the rest of us, to say how important they found it to spend that time with God, and to spend that day with God in that way. And so they were able to encourage their Israelite countrymen to have that, not just that faith, but that practice of serving God. And that's why, that's part of why there was a strong Judaism as a system by the time of Christ, where you got the Pharisees and Sadducees and chief priests and teachers of law, is they finally found the Pax Romana was the peace of Rome, the good news of Rome, as they called it, that through the good news of Caesar, was that he had brought this Roman peace to the world. I mean, the way you do that is first killing a bunch of people and conquering them. Once you've conquered them, now there's peace. That was the idea that Rome brought, was we're not just going to make you our subjects and our servants and our slaves. We're actually going to conquer you and then bring peace. We're going to bring peace by security. We have an army that can stand up against outside threats. We have roads that we're going to build. We have civic life and centers and arenas or coliseums and all these things that we're going to build. For them, they thought it was a good idea to build temples, so we're going to build temples. But what did they do? The Jewish temple, the second temple period that came with Herod, during the time of Herod, he built that temple with Roman funds, essentially, that was meant to keep the Jews happy and keep them. And as long as there's peace, and as long as you don't overburden them too much, the Jews are happy with this, except for a few, you know, the zealots who wanted to overthrow Rome. But most of them are willing to accept Roman occupation, as long as they don't crucify too many of them, because they did crucify a lot of them, as long as they don't, you know, really put a burden on them or make them try to eat pork or avoid the Sabbaths and the festivals at the temple and all that. Most Jews are happy enough with this, which I can see pluses and minuses to it, but can you imagine going from years of exile, years of occupation and continual warfare against your neighboring nation, and now having the Pax Romana and a temple and synagogues and being able to go about freely? We would all probably be pretty okay with that, right? But during that time of persecution, there were horrible atrocities were committed to people to try to force them to not be Jews, essentially. And it didn't matter whether it was old men or children or old women, they applied it to many of them as a public spectacle to try to get them to recant their faith and to basically follow the Greek ways or the Roman ways at that point. And Maccabees contains a lot of stories of people who valiantly maintained their faith as they're being tortured and, you know, put to death. So when it says the world was not worthy of them, that's what it means. All these people are getting, I mean, like, demonically possessed in their violence against them. And these people smiled in the midst of it and said, "You can do whatever you want to me, because I serve a living God, and I'll see him. So if you end me now, you end me now. That's fine. My life isn't over." That's the kind of faith that they had. And so when it says the world was not worthy of them, that's what it means. That's who it's talking about. This writer is talking directly about that.
So that's because these people were being persecuted.
Yeah.
So he's trying to tell them that persecution
has come again to the church now, not to the Jews, but to the church.
And right.
But he's writing to Hebrews. These were Jewish Christians. And so he's saying, like, our people have been persecuted before. We've had a good run for a little while now, like since about, I think it was around the year 63 BC was when the independence came. And so after the year 70 is when the temple was destroyed and everything, you know, went bad again for them. So, you know, you got, what, 133 years or so of good stuff, you know, good times, essentially. I mean, could have been better, but now that's over. Now you're getting persecuted again. Don't worry. We've got a history of that. So as those people had faith in those times, you have faith. And he'll say later in chapter, I think it's 13, he'll say, remember those who are in prison. Yeah, verse 3, 13, 3. Remember those in prison. He's not talking about people like that did a crime and got thrown in jail. He's talking about believers who are in prison
because
of their faith in Christ and their practice. And so he's saying, even if you're in prison or you're tortured or killed, there's people that the world wasn't worthy of. in the past. They had faith in those times, so you too can have faith.
Yes. Persecution. So some people say that the word did not spread until people were persecuted, and then because they weren't doing what they were supposed to do, because they weren't going out and telling. But I thought persecution was a result of minding God doing his will.
Okay, so let's say yes, that is the result of it. Like, if those who were doing the will of God and preaching about Christ, those were the ones who, let's see, they were persecuted. They were being faithful. Then everybody's persecuted. Then the people spread out. Like, because of that persecution, the church was scattered. I mean, Acts says that in whatever, after Stephen's death, was it chapter 7? Says that on that day a great persecution broke out, like the day that Stephen was martyred, a great persecution broke out and the church was scattered. That's where they started moving. Then where Saul goes on his journey, like all the way up to Damascus, like he's chasing people down, he's hunting them down. But did I just say haunting them? I did, but it's actually correct. He was haunting them down. Hunting them down, but it was really, they were haunted by him. He was haunting them. Haunting them down. So that persecution, I would say, resulted from faithfulness, but resulted in increased disbursement of the gospel, because it's just like embers flying out of a fire might land on a pile of leaves and ignite them, which I found to not be true, actually. I think they lied to us about forest fires, and I don't trust Smokey Bear. Forest fires start from lightning most of the time, not from campfires. I've tried to light fires before and couldn't when I tried to, you know? So I don't think an errant spark is setting whole, you know, like California, you know, Hawaii. These didn't burn from somebody's bad campfire, okay? It burned from a power line in a lightning storm in Hawaii, or a space laser, I'm not sure which. But anyway... I mean, I've heard that that's a possibility. It could be. I'm not going to say no. But anyway. So.
You must have one of those drones on your mind. That
yeah, I do. Constantly.
The laser messed me. Out of space.
Well, it's not impossible. Was it Project Bluebeam, maybe? I think it's called Project Bluebeam.
I think it's time to land the plane.
That's good. We're about out of stuff here. I love verses 39 and 40 here at the very end. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. Okay, here's my question to you. What does, so that only together with us, what does that part mean? The last two verses, the last verse.
Would you read them again?
They were all commended for their faith, all these people that we had just talked about. They were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. These people didn't receive what was promised. God had something better for us, and so that only together with us would they be made perfect.
Jesus.
Yes, but...
Well, the promise...
How are these dead people going to have it with these currently alive people?
When Jesus died and went and...
After...
To the...
Yes.
No.
Yes, but it also implies...
We both have the promise of heaven and eternal life.
He's saying, because he had talked about Abraham looking towards a city... that wasn't built with human hands.
Which was so, Jerusalem.
Yeah, and so what he's really saying here is, essentially, you guys haven't fully received it yet either. Right. You guys haven't fully received it yet either, because you have to die to get there. That city that God has made for us is not one made with human hands, and so as long as you're alive on this earth, that's not it. So in other words, we too haven't fully received what's been promised. We received Christ, and that was for sure the promise. But the ultimate promise of Christ is about his return.
Yeah.
And in his return, he brings with him the new heavens and the new earth. Yeah. Jesus told his disciples, I'm going away, to prepare a place for you, so that where I am, you can be there with me. Now, a lot of times people assume that meant, oh, we have to go to heaven. Read the last two chapters. Jesus says, I'm bringing, like, he's dragging it along behind him when he returns. He said, I'm bringing the new heavens and the new earth. I'll cleanse the old one with fire. It was just gone away. Just gone, new one. Look, I don't know how that happens, but I also don't know how God said, let there be, and there was. So I don't have to worry about that. Like what the guy Descartes said, I think, therefore I am.
Yeah.
And then I saw a cartoon recently that said, it showed somebody with their mind being blown, and said Descartes realizing that some people exist and still aren't thinking, or something like that. Like, some of these people don't think, but yet they're here. Well, anyway, like, I know I'm here. At least I'm pretty sure I'm here. There's also, like, even deeper theory out there than the Project Bluebeam space lasers is the people that believe that our life is just, we're in a simulation and this isn't real.
Oh, my.
Anyway, like, I suppose that's technically possible, you know? But anyway. But anyway, assuming that's not the case, which I don't believe it is, the reality is, like, somehow I got here. I believe that God did that. And I also heard something recently. It's easier. Everybody believes. There's a lot of people that don't believe in the virgin birth of Jesus. They say that's insane. And somebody said, I'd rather believe in that virgin birth than the evolutionary one that people talk about, where this earth came from nothing. Yeah, and people and life came from nothing.
Yeah.
Then, you know, like, how hard is it? If you can believe that, then how hard is it to believe that God can, you know, put a baby inside of a woman that way? Pretty cool. So anyway, we wrapping this chapter up, you know, we're faithful to look at people throughout all of history that lived against all odds. They lived against sometimes the normal accepted way of life. And they didn't just say, I'm not going to live according to this culture. They actually lived by the rules of eternity. They lived with eternity in mind. Not just, I'm going to live different than everybody else right now. They actually said, I'm going to live with eternity in mind. And so I'd invite you to look at your life, reflect on that, and say, you know, what things are, you know, kind of a big eternal nature. Wrap chapter 11 up with that.